Listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, I'm Sue Nelson and this is the Food Talk Show, and I'm joined by Guy Routledge of the Food Rush. Hi Guy.
Hi Sue, how are you?
Very, very good. Hot again.
Yes, it's still quite warm here, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And by Ollie Lloyd from Great British Chefs. Hi Ollie.
How are you doing?
You missed last week.
I know, I'm sorry.
We had toast ale and we were drinking beer and everything, yeah, and you missed it.
I missed the wine one as well. I keep getting my timings wrong.
You certainly do. And today we're joined by Jack Fleming of Soup and Rick Hay, who is a superfoodist. We're going to find out all about that later. Before we go over to our lovely guests, you've just got some more research, because you love a bit of research, don't you, Ollie? And we've got some really interesting stuff about global food and a cooking survey you've done. Can we have a bit of a discussion about that?
Yeah, so on Great British Chefs, we do a lot of research to understand what foodies are cooking. And when we did some research earlier in the year, we were sort of blown away by the fact that the average foodie is cooking regularly and occasionally kind of 91 dishes. And we saw the emergence of sort of dishes that we thought were really, really niche becoming much more mainstream. So we wanted to kind of start this project almost again by starting at a cuisine level and understanding what cuisines are people cooking. And so we tried to dig into what cuisines people are cooking in terms of from a national perspective, but also then what really super specialist ingredients that they're then also buying and where they're buying them.
And this is cooking from scratch? Not getting a jar of something?
Yeah,
not just cooking from scratch.
I mean, obviously, there are certain ingredients like oyster sauce that you need to be insane to make from scratch. But, you know, broadly speaking, they're making things from scratch with some pre-made ingredients like oyster sauce.
And your research is about foodies. So people sort of self-select, don't they, for these surveys?
So the way we started to define the foodie over this year, really, and what we've come to is that in the UK, there are about 14 million individuals, about a third of the UK 18 to 74-year-old population, who are foodies. And that breaks down into two levels of foodies. There's something we call the committed foodie, who agrees strongly with 4 out of 10 statements. And then there's a sort of what we call the weekend foodie, who agrees strongly with 2 to 3 statements. Mm. And then obviously exhibit other habits as well. Mm. And so those two groups, both about 7 million each, give us the sort of the lens into the world. And what we're now starting to do is segment across those two different audiences to understand what the super committed are doing. So you're starting to pick up early trends, and then you're also seeing what the kind of more mass market foodie is doing.
So the sort of super foodie, yep, so to speak, is somebody who's probably ahead of the curve and is picking up on trends, and you like watching those because they seem to feed into what the general foodie population will do and then what the general population will do.
Absolutely. We see a trickle down, which basically starts from influencers, be those bloggers, Instagram legends, chefs, influencers, media, etc., talking about stuff. And that stuff then is picked up by one community and then another. Sometimes it will come through a health food world. Sometimes it will come through a kind of a more experimental cuisine world. So take something like cocoa nibs, you know, started very, very niche, but becoming much, much, much more mass market now. So you get ingredients like that that will go on some kind of a journey from being a trend in a very, very small community that then gets amplified on TV, in the press, etc. And then it's picked up. And because the content that we create comes from Britain's greatest chefs and bloggers, we are generally creating, we aren't even necessarily seeing the trend, but suddenly we go, oh, it's interesting.
There's
this ingredient keeps coming up, or we keep getting this kind of stuff from the people we're working with.
I guess the only way to see those trends is through the data that you gather, which is, you know, a huge amount. I had a quick peek at it before we started recording, and some really interesting stuff in there.
Well, we're going to go through that, I think, because there's some interesting stuff happening. So you're saying that these sort of super foodies and then these foodies, about 14 million sort of adults in the UK.
Yep.
How much is that of the adult population?
So
is that about
a third? It's a third of the UK population.
So about a third of the UK are really, really into their food in a foodie way.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of people.
It is a lot of people. And we've got very specific statements that they're agreeing with. Yeah. And what we're starting to map is where they're shopping. You know, Tesco still outperforms everyone else.
Oh dear, really?
It's Tesco. So amongst the really committed foodie audience, you know, 50% of them are shopping regularly at Tesco's.
Is that a geographical convenience, you think?
I think it's the fact that actually Tesco's, if you look at their broad range, actually, because their superstores are massive, they actually do generally have the depth that other people don't have.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, actually, they are in lots of places where there isn't a Waitrose or a Sainsbury's. But it's really Waitrose, Sainsbury's and Tesco's that dominate.
The thing with the supermarkets is a double-edged sword for me. You know, there's lots about the supermarkets I don't like. I think they have destroyed local communities, actually, in some respects. And, you know, and they can't even bear to see a corner shop surviving. They then do sort of local, you know, to try and get those out of business. And I know that's business and that's their model, but it does upset me quite a bit. And yet, on the other hand, they have opened up to, you know, the UK consumer ingredients and stuff that we would never get through local shops because it's not sustainable and it's not, you know, it's not viable.
Yeah.
It's not practical.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it's got great benefits, hasn't it? But great downsides.
Totally. And, you know, it's interesting. So we asked the question in this recent Asian or ethnic international, I never quite know the right word to use, but when we were saying, we specifically asked the question of when you're cooking for Asian dishes, where do you go for your ingredients? And actually, you know, mainstream supermarkets are still 78%.
Yeah.
That's where they go. But 40% of people are going to local specialist ethnic Asian stores that actually allow them to get, you know, really, really kind of specialist ingredients.
And is that much higher than it used to be?
We haven't got historical data on this, but I think it's one of those things where, you know, how do people discover different cuisines? Mm. I mean, one part of it is what trendsetters are doing. The other part of it is what travel they've done. So, you know, you go to Croatia for the first time and you discover, I don't know, a pekka, and you're like, what's a pekka? That's a great dish. Let's try and recreate it at home.
Yeah.
And the same thing is, you know, with more and more people visit places like Bali and India and Thailand, you start to pick up those cuisines. Mexico is massively on the rise from a destination perspective, from a UK consumer perspective. That rises it up. Israel, et cetera, et cetera. So you get all of this kind of stuff where travel is feeding ingredient interest and is feeding the dishes that people are cooking.
So let's have a look at this survey. So you've got some, you know, I think the question that you're asking is which of the following cuisines do you cook at home from scratch? So we emphasise from scratch. Top of that list. So you've got regularly, occasionally. What does regularly and occasionally mean? That's just those two things combined. Okay,
that's
cool.
The two combined.
So regularly and occasionally, top of the list is Italian. I presume that's no surprise to you.
No, I mean, and just to be clear, we didn't put British in there. And we then debated after and went, should we have put British in there? You know, and actually, we then had sort of, you know, sort of crisis of confidence afterwards. And we're like, actually, should we have? And I think we probably need to do some stuff to define what British food is nowadays.
Do you think any of that is because you also have, great British chefs, you also have great Italian chefs. So is there maybe a bit of a little bit of bias in the data there?
I think it's more driven by the fact that, you know, when we've looked at historical data and you say, what are the dishes that you cook from scratch regularly? The reality is a lot of these cuisines are defined by a dish type. So that might be pasta, that might be, you know, risotto. And actually, you know, pasta, risotto and pizza are kind of staples in a foodie home. Yeah. And people like creating them from scratch.
And they're quite easy and straightforward and tasty and
but
homely as well.
But your chief executive are great British chefs, aren't they? And you haven't put British in there. And is that because we're such eclectic people and you know, the UK has been so open to all sorts of influences that actually people find it difficult to define British food?
I would say so.
I mean, when we did the survey, we were specifically trying to understand what non-British food was on the rise. That's really what we were saying. And I think, you know, so we were trying to understand, so what are the cuisines that people turn to? You know, is Jamie's food Italian? Yes, it's inspired by Italy, but it's actually probably become parts of it quite British in its own way.
Anglicised Italian. Mm, yeah, like anglicised Indian food.
Yeah, and you know, so the second one on the list is Indian.
Mm.
And I think, you know, what's interesting to me is that, you know, French scores 3. And I think, you know, if we did this survey...
What is French then?
Well, you see, it's an interesting question.
I'm surprised by that one because French cuisine, when you eat it out in a restaurant, tends to be quite elaborate or fancy even. So maybe for a special occasion, you might go to a, you know, posh Michelin star restaurant or something like that. I'm surprised that people are cooking it at home. I mean, I guess the only thing I've probably cooked at home that would be classic French is like a French onion soup or something.
Beef bourguignon, I think.
Potato, perhaps.
I guess so.
You know, I think there's more there than...
We realise
these days. If I look back to what my mother cooked, all my mother's early cookbooks were French cookbooks.
Well, that was seen as foreign food then. You know,
exactly.
You know, Elizabeth David and all that sort of opened that out.
Yeah.
But, okay, so let's look at Italian. So no surprise, regularly 76%, occasionally 30%. And that's because it is ice cream, I guess, or...
It's everything.
Pizza, pasta, risotto.
it's got staples there that always score for us, and the top, you know, 75% of people are cooking these dishes.
And most of that is because it's reasonably quick,
yep,
by its nature. All the ingredients are pretty easy to get hold of, I'm, yep, thinking. And actually, you can cook them badly quite easily. You can cook them well, you know, quite easily as well. But you can get away with sort of, you know, average skills in order to produce a quite decent Italian meal.
But I think
if you've got the right ingredients.
I think you can also dial up and dial down. So, you know, the fact is, a simple pasta dish with a beautiful, you know, tomato sauce with a few fresh basil leaves is lovely. But you can go all the other end of the spectrum and have a really elaborate seafood pasta dish, which is like, you know, really expensive and includes lots of amazing ingredients. So I think one of the things in Italian food is you can literally do it from store cupboard essentials without buying a single new thing. But you can also go out and say, right, I'm very specific about the pasta I want to buy. I'm very specific about, you know, the types of tomato, the types of basil, the types of oil, etc. And you can really dial it up.
And you think that people are actually making their own pasta, possibly?
No, I mean, I think there is. I think a few do. I think it's about 25% in our audience. But the reality is dry pasta, like, no one is making their own spaghetti. I mean, no one's making their own fusilli. Like, actually, some of the classic pasta, and a lot of the Italians, will eat dried pasta.
Yeah. I mean, I make ravioli because I like stuffing things in it that's different. And, you know, probably that's different. But why would I make my own spaghetti?
You wouldn't.
No.
And the fact is, you know, with companies like, you know, Barilla, you've got, you know, a company that's been making the same, you know, spaghetti for 100 years. And they kind of know how to do it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So next on the list is Indian. And again, people are cooking it regularly. 52%, occasionally 45%, so not much difference there. Indian, what do you think people are cooking there? So just curry, but do you think they're cooking the accompaniments around it?
I think they're doing more and more. I mean, look, I think they're not buying their own mango chutney. I mean, they're buying their own mango chutney, they're not making
rather
that stuff from scratch. Are they making their own naans? I think you're starting to see more breads being made. I think there is an interest in breads.
I can never get it thin enough.
Yeah.
I always find it a bit stodgy in the middle because you need that really, really hot, like the tandoor oven. And it's very hard to do that with your domestic equipment. But you know, homemade bread is fantastic. And it's actually pretty quick to throw together, even like a flatbread.
I make to parties a lot, though. They're really, really easy. And they're just as nice.
Yeah. And I think, again, you know, it also comes down to, well, if you were to actually, I haven't got this data, look at all the restaurants in the UK, most towns of whatever size have an Indian restaurant.
At least one.
Yeah, exactly.
And, even if not very good.
And even if you're dealing with the sort of the takeaway world, Indian tops the list. You go into the ready-made world, Indian tops the list. So actually, I think in the area of Indian, you've got a lot of of dishes that people feel they can throw together. And actually, a bit of curry paste, a few things cooked down. You know, are they doing it authentically? I think in our audience, probably doing it more authentically than others.
Yeah.
But there are attainable dishes that people go, oh, I do curry Friday night. And I hear that a lot. You know, it's the sort of thing that you repeat, the family like, the couple like, you do it, you enjoy it. It's, you know, it's curry night in.
Just got to have spice on Friday. That's what I think.
Exactly.
On the end of the week. So third is French, as we've said already.
Yeah.
I'm struggling to actually understand what that might be because we're saying 42% cook that regularly, 51% occasionally. That's very high and not what I would expect. And I'm just trying to think, beef bourguignon, maybe some soups. Is there anything that
think a lot of British dishes, some foodies would acknowledge their French heritage. So I think it's an understanding. You know, you might say steak and chips is French. You know,
good question.
So you know, there's interesting things where, you know, if you're making
mussels,
creme brulees,
maybe.
If you're making, you know, moules marinières, there are lots of dishes that you probably don't think as being French, but actually have a French history. And if you are a foodie and into this kind of stuff, you do sort of engage with that.
And of course, lots of lovely French cheeses, although I do think English cheeses are better. Fourth on the list, Chinese. I'm not a great fan of Chinese. And I think for me, the reason for that is Chinese takeaway experience is generally dreadful. It used to be incredible decades and decades ago, I think, but it has reached the realm of deep fried often.
Yeah, it's pretty worrying. There's a Chinese restaurant that I walk past on my way home whenever I'm out and about, and it's always open really, really late, and it just looks really rough around the edges.
Whereas if you get the right ingredients and stir fry Chinese, it's gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. And I think what's interesting in Chinese is I think, you know, we have been kind of subjected to, you know, bad, you know, fake Chinese, which has been sort of full of, you know,
it's not Chinese at all.
No, it's not. And I think, you know, in London we've seen the explosion in regional Chinese food.
Yeah.
And I think we're starting to see a much more educated, you know, growth of different ingredients and stuff. And a lot of this stuff is driven by brand. So the question on some of these questions is which brand is driving the pickup of those things? Because these cuisines, like if you take Mexican as an interesting example, who's driven Mexican? Well, it's probably Thomasina Myers winning MasterChef, the creation of Oaxaca, then the emergence of restaurants like Bredos. There's now an online Mexican store, so it's about 25% at the moment.
I think Mexican drinks are driving it as well.
Yeah.
You know, there's you know, the tequilas and some
mojitos,
of the beers.
And mojitos. Well, mezcal is huge as well now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so maybe that's having an effect as well.
Yeah, I think that you know, for a cuisine to kind of go on the ascendancy, you need it to be a destination that people are going to. You need to have the online ability or retail ability to get the ingredients. You need certain dishes that what we call act as transitional dishes into that cuisine. So unless you can, you know, you sort of knock up a simple dish quite easily, then you'll be put off by it. So take Chinese, I think, is an interesting example. People make, you know, duck and pancakes, right? Now, that's a really easy dish to cook at home. It's an absolute classic. It's expensive in restaurants. It's lovely to do in your home environment.
It's a very sharing meal, isn't it?
And, you know, it's one of those family favourites that just everyone loves. So I think if you've got dishes like that within your cuisine and you've got people pushing them, then I think you get to an interesting place.
So Mexican is six, and we know we've got tortillas and chili and all sorts of things. And as you say,
burritos, tacos,
yeah, I do think so.
All of that good stuff.
You know, that's been driven a lot by perhaps Thomasina Myers and others. But Spanish is fifth. And now we had the lovely Barrafina.
Brindisa.
Monica.
We had
Barrafina. God, I've got that on the brain.
Monica
from Brindisa a couple of weeks ago. She's surely instrumental in driving some of that, bringing some of those ingredients over here.
Yeah, I think she is. I mean, that is one of the ones where one of our team is Catalan. She's like, well, what are they actually cooking in that list?
Yeah.
Is it actually Spanish?
I'm interested,
And I think it's quite an interesting one because when we've done dish analysis, we have seen dishes picked up which are, you know, what I'll call faux Spanish. You know, are people doing them right or wrong? This is probably one of those ones. I don't think Spanish has been as picked up as it could be.
Oh, I agree. I think it's got a way to go. I love paella.
Although that being
making
said, I was at Taste of London a few weeks back, and there was I noticed quite a large number of little Spanish bits and pieces. And maybe it was just because we had Monica on the show recently, and I was kind of aware of that discussion that we'd had about it not being as well picked up. But there was a lot of stuff there.
And then we've got Thai, seventh. Again, people cooking that at home, they're thinking of that
Thai
as curry.
Green curry.
Oh,
yeah.
They're thinking of it as curries and things like that.
I mean, and again, I think Thai green curry is one of those things. A lot of people have Thai green paste in their home.
Yeah.
You know, in the end, all you end up doing is cooking the paste out,
get
throwing some
lemongrass,
veg in, throw a bit of stuff in. Happy days.
Yeah.
And they might not even be going to the length of putting lemongrass in. Actually, simple Tuesday night dinner. Got the curry paste, I've got some coconut milk, I've got some ingredients, happy days. It's chopping and
I presume people are classifying coconut milk as Thai, are they possibly?
Probably.
Yeah. Greek. Now that's something that I don't cook at all. So that's eighth, and we're talking about 21% of people cooking that regularly, 63% occasionally.
Again,
sort of thing.
So that's is it moussaka? Is it Greek salad? Is it anything with feta in it? Is it anything
with Greek yogurt on the top?
Yeah, well, exactly. And this, again, is one of those things where, you know, for us, this is the start of another journey.
Yeah,
we constantly open up these things where you kind of go, well, let's start at a benchmark. So people are cooking Greek dishes. Let's ask the question, what's a Greek dish?
What is it? Yeah.
I mean, I think the interesting ones, did you get further down? So North American.
I was going to say, so we've got North American at ninth, which is 18% regularly, half of cooking what they consider to be North American occasionally. Now, that's below Mexico and below Greece, you know, Greek food.
Well, I'm assuming that's a burger.
Do you reckon?
Burgers or maybe barbecue food as well,
barbecue,
like, you know,
burgers.
Southern American style.
Some ribs, or sometimes sticky ribs, maybe.
So, I mean, it basically involves a dead animal and a lot of cooking. I mean, that's basically the idea.
Well, that whole
dead
slow,
animal,
slow
between
thing
some
is,
bread.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then we've got a whole range coming down here.
But you see, Moroccan is really interesting for me because that's driven
11th,
by...
The 10th, rather.
By tagine.
Yeah.
So if you've got one dish, you know, that's a killer dish, and people are going to Morocco more and more, loads of EasyJet, Ryanair flights. And if you get that kind of combination of flights, lovely place, simple dish, up you go in the rankings.
I've never been so disappointed in Moroccan food as when I went to Marrakesh. I really, really expected
which
it
is surprising.
To be quite spicy and whatever, it wasn't. I was really, really surprised. Do you think they've got so many visitors there now that they're dumbing it down?
Maybe it depends where
you go. This is probably controversial and probably
go
wrong.
Go on, we like being controversial.
But I mean, we go to Morocco quite often. It's like one of our sort of like winter sun places. And I'd get really bored of the food after 2 or 3 days because I think it's really repetitive. Mm. And I'm, you know, okay, so we've got 2 young children, so we're not really pushing the boundaries, going out to all the special places. And I think they do some really interesting stuff, but you can only eat a tagine so many days.
Times. Mm. Yeah. So underneath the sort of regularly cooking things, you know, 10%, so maybe cooking something one or two days a fortnight. We've got Japanese there. And then underneath that, we've got a whole range of things that people are cooking very occasionally. Things like Pakistani, Bangladeshi, people are actually deciding that that is different from Indian food or understanding that it's different.
So when we got this list back, the team and I were talking about it, I was prompted by one of the conversations that you and I had a while ago where we said, actually, is the foodie community less, you know, of British descent, pure British descent, than actually the national average? We don't know that data point.
Mm. But that might be foodies who've got a Pakistani sort of background or family who are cooking very specific dishes, is what you're saying, possibly. Yeah.
And or have had experience of that world because they're connected into it. They've got good friends who are from that place. And therefore they've, you know, what we know about our audience is that 77% of, you know, at least the Great British Chef's foodie audience is ABC1. Nationally, it's 56%. So you've got a more affluent group. They're traveling more. They're going to more, you know, interesting places. They're interested in food. So they are understanding the differences between Bangladeshi food and Indian food.
Yeah.
And actually, therefore, they're able to say, well, no, it's this rather than this. Yeah. And that's part of the story and the narrative.
One here is German. Now, I, for the life of me, have never ever had any decent food from Germany or that is German. And there must be some great, great German cuisine, but I really struggle to find it.
They have more Michelin stars than we do.
Well, what sort of food then? Because I really struggle to find it. I think it's dreadful.
It's really modernist European cuisine.
Well, tell me where I need to go. You know, so what city would you go to in Germany to get it? Because I've just find it dreadful.
Berlin, I mean, has a lot going on. And I think there are... I think it can be quite heavy.
What was it, sausage and sauerkraut?
I mean, but I think that's the same as saying the British is fish and chips. Yeah. And we're not fish and chips anymore. No. We do fish and chips. Yeah. We do great fish and chips. They will do great sausages. And, you know, as I was explaining to my niece the other day, German sausages are not Frankfurters.
No,
right?
Let's be very clear about this. No.
Yeah. So I think there is, I think German food is, you know, we've always joked that actually the one cuisine that really needs as much help as British cuisine internationally is, you know, the German. So great German chefs, we've always thought would be like one of the most extraordinary projects we could ever do.
Like having a famous Belgian.
Exactly, yes. Exactly.
Well, I mean, I would love to know more about German food and I'd love to understand how that has its own identity because as somebody who eats out a lot and is a foodie and writes a lot about food and comes across food a lot, doesn't come across at all to me.
I tell you one of the ones that I'd be really interested in is like, let's forecast 10 years ahead. Polish regularly is at 2%. Mm. We have a massive Polish community in this country. Yep. You've got to assume that in the next 2 to 3 years, we're going to start to see some of the major Polish chefs open up here, create standout Michelin star quality food, then start to create brands around that, start to build understanding of what is Polish food, what is this about, start to create an identity. And I think that's some of the exciting stuff. We've seen the impact of, you know, the large communities of other communities, basically their food becoming adopted by the national audience. Yep. But we haven't yet seen Polish adopted. We haven't seen some of the other cuisines. Like Portuguese, again, is quite low, but actually one might expect that to go high.
Yeah. Mm. Because for me, the Spanish food is amazing. Portuguese is amazing with spice. I mean, you know, Spanish food with spice almost. I mean, almost the founders of Chile, really.
Yeah.
And also looking down on this list, I think it's very interesting that we're getting Jamaican food. It's up there, you see that quite a lot in London, you know, street food particularly. But it's a shame to see Nigerian food so low down. And I would expect some of those African cuisines to start coming up, actually.
But again, I think, you know, where would you go and eat a really good Nigerian, you know, where would you go and eat and have a really good Nigerian restaurant experience?
Well, it says here that regularly 0% of people cook Nigerian.
And I think you know...
and occasionally 5%. So it's really, really low on the radar.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Who's championing that? You know, probably the biggest of the Jamaican brands are people like Encona, Grace Foods, you know, guys like that. But actually, unless you've got sort of an you know, an infrastructure of, you know, the tourism board, certain local brands, interest in travel, etc. If that doesn't come together, you're not going to see changes in this.
Absolutely.
I wonder if it's also too specific, you know, singling out a single country in a massive continent. And I think a lot of people would probably lump a lot of those styles of things together, even though they are so different.
But you're not seeing that with the Mexican, Peruvian,
no,
Argentinian. So it's interesting. And if I said to you, fast forward to today, 10 years ago, and we're going to have people understand the difference between Mexican, Peruvian, you know, an Argentinian.
You wouldn't believe that.
You wouldn't believe it. You'd be like, no, that's never going to happen.
Also good to see Persian and stuff like that there. There's great cuisine and Persian cuisine.
But again, driven by a couple of bloggers who've produced a few good books.
And some good food writers as well. Just going over to Rick Hay, who's a superfoodist. We're going to learn all about him later. Any particular favourite cuisines that you have? I mean, you're into health. So what would you, if you were a healthy foodie like you, where would you sort of regularly go?
Well, you know what?
From?
I think a lot of the Asian cuisines are where I start from. My clients and any of my recipe books as well, just because you're getting such a wide variety of vegetables used, as you say, and it's fast for people. I mean, you've got to be careful with what oil choice you're making there, but it's a good one. And I think everybody wants something that's fast, is what I find. They want to be healthy, but they want to have
but
fast
they want it to
stuff
be convenient.
As well. Yeah. So that would be my standard, a sort of stir fry. I often say to people as well, at least with the stir fry, if you are tending to eat too much meat, you can cut it down a little bit in the stir fry, but still get the flavour and the taste in there, and that keeps them satisfied. So that'd be top on the list. And Indian as well. I think it's really up there, especially if somebody's embarking on the new, but on the current vegan trend that's taken off massively.
Absolutely.
Indian really does cover that one. And strange enough, so can Italian as well.
I was going to say, there are some that naturally lend itself to that. And, you know, an Italian and Indian are fairly easy, aren't they? Do you think there is a drive that why those two are even more popular than ever? Because you can so easily cut out meat or be vegan?
I mean, vegan is 3% of the UK. So that's
but growing quite fast, isn't it?
Well,
part-time. I think you get part-time vegans.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I think flexitarians, we call them.
I mean, I think the vegan community is 3% in the UK, and there are more of them in the young. Now, the question is, will that trend continue? A, will they remain vegan? And will the next generation of young become vegan? Mm. So I think that's currently where the data sits at the moment. I think that people are becoming more interested in health. You know, 60% of ABs will say they're concerned about what they look at what they're taking into their body, etc. And I think that will drive people away from certain meats into various fish and into more veg and stuff. So I think that's certainly the case.
We're also joined by Jack Fleming of Soup, and again we'll talk about soup in a minute. What's your favourite? Do you cook yourself? I mean, I know you've got this culinary.
Yeah, I think. I think when you're working with food the whole time, you get slightly bored of cooking at home. You know, so you slightly switch off. I think it's a really tough one for me. I'd say, well, I spent 5 years in Bradford, which has a really, really strong...
Lots of curry.
Lots of curry.
Did you do that on purpose, Jack?
I kind of did, I think.
Yeah. But Bradford's got some great
absolutely
places
stunning,
to eat.
Really stunning food. Yeah. And I think this really interesting conversation where we sort of delve deeper into what do we mean by Pakistani, Northern Pakistani food, which is quite different to the south. Really, really good food, and Greek as well.
And your favourite? What are you cooking? If you do cook, if you manage to cook,
favourite dish?
Or countries? Countries that you sort of naturally lean towards?
A lot of Indian food, a lot of good curries, a couple of moussakas.
Moussaka,
really good, yeah. A lot of Greek food.
Great.
You know, one pot dishes. See what you got in the cupboard. Quite good.
But I think what's interesting is, you know, your sort of northern Pakistan, southern Pakistan, is this is what we're seeing, which is, you know, Italian food is a joke. I mean, that is so, you know, you talk about the difference between northern Italian food and southern Italian food, like Sicilian food bears no resemblance to a lot of the other food in Italy. Mm. And actually the really interesting part that I think is beginning to sort of disintegrate is that people are starting to understand different regions and that, you know, I mean, how can you describe Indian food? I mean, Indian food is, you know, I lived in India for a year, and you know what happens in the north is completely different. What happens in Kerala and Bombay, you know, so you've kind of got these very complicated differences that I think people are beginning to understand.
Well, fascinating research. And is this going to be on the Great British Chef's website? How do we? So if anybody wants to see, you know, especially if they're developing, you know, a food business and want to understand trends,
yeah,
where
so
can they go
on greatbritishchefs.com/insight, you'll see all the publications we've done. We've got two in the works at the moment. This is literally raw data. We still haven't sub-segmented it.
Yeah, you
by
just sent it to me
on an
dreadful
Excel.
Spreadsheet.
Sorry, apologies. it seemed like an interesting opportunity.
It's that hot.
It was downloaded last night.
Yes.
So we'll be publishing the next couple of weeks. But yeah, get in touch if you want to know more.
Yeah, and I do think if you have got a food business, you really need to understand where these things are going, because you need to build it into your business plan, don't you? And be aware of trends, and so that you can respond to them.
I mean, there are some really interesting, like who is driving Polish food? That is a massive opportunity. Who's driving Japanese food? Again, that's underutilized. Are the brands that are playing in each of these cuisines, they know what they want to drive? Do they understand the change they want to seek? Mm. And I think that's where, you know, some of the opportunities in the food world sit. We talk to a lot of people who are running ice cream businesses and who are running, you know, new crisp businesses or, you know, pork scratchings, which is all great. But actually, it's actually this area is a lot less competitive.
Yes.
If you pick a cuisine like Mexican, you've got an amazing spectrum of stuff you could do as a brand in that area.
Yeah, and supplying that demand for for that interest in
supplying and creating it.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, well, we're going to have a quick break now, and we'll be back in a few minutes, and we'll be talking to Jack Fleming of Soup and Rick Hay of Superfoodis. See you in a few minutes. I'm with my producer, Lucy, and we're wandering around the Food Matters Live show, and we've come across Liam Pennington, and we've tried to interview Liam, I don't know how many times, Lucy, dozens of times.
I think he's probably ignoring us.
I think he is ignoring us, but we decided it's no good, we've pinned him down, and the reason why we've never been able to speak to him is because his product is so popular. So let me describe it to you. I'm standing in front of his stand now, and he's got jelly juice. And I love jelly, and I can't be bothered to make it. So there's jelly juice, and we've got tropical fruits, apple and blackcurrant, and summer fruits. And they're in a pouch with a really nice lid on. And that sort of pouch, I guess you just squeeze into your mouth, is that right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And this isn't just aimed at children, is it?
No, predominantly sort of children are our core market. But, you know, big kids and little kids, you're only as old as you feel.
That's me.
So if you like jelly and you like juice, it's absolutely for you. The same health benefits that apply to children certainly apply to adults. You know, it's only 36 calories per pouch, no added sugar, no sweeteners, and only 1.5 teaspoons of naturally occurring fruit sugar per pouch.
So this is, it's actually jelly that you can drink, have I got that right?
Yep, absolutely. So we use a vegetarian and vegan thickener. That gives it that jelly sort of taste and texture. But yeah, it's just fruit juice, water, and then the natural thickener to give it that sort of wiggly wobbly jelly texture.
I'm going to get Lucy to ask some questions, because can I taste one, please?
Absolutely.
Am I allowed? Hold on. There you go. Lucy, I'm just going to hand the microphone over to you.
So how's the show going for you?
Yeah, the show's been really good. This is the second day of three. It's always good to come to the shows. Obviously, this show's really good because the focus is around health. All the products in the sort of enterprise zone where we are, we're all new startups with a health focus, so that's good. Unfortunately, you know, you don't always see these up and coming brands in the supermarkets where most people shop every day. So when you come to these shows on a personal level, it's great because you get to meet the new brands, new brand owners, share stories, but yeah,
and get some ideas as well. And,
yeah, we're good on a personal level, so when I go home, I know what I can look out for and different things that I can try to.
I've just tasted this now, Lucy, and it is jelly. It is jelly, but it's in a pouch. So if you like jelly, quite good for kids because of the texture of it as well. And so quite young children, I would imagine, can have this.
So what we found is that as children get a little bit older, after school, after nursery, they come home and all they say is they're starving. Any parents listening will know all about sort of backseat or kitchen tantrums. So we wanted to make something that kids first and foremost enjoy as fun. But yeah, it's packed full of health benefits that they can then enjoy, and they don't think it's carrot sticks, and they don't think it's sort of...
Do you need to refrigerate it?
It doesn't need to be chilled.
It's quite nice cold though, isn't it?
Yeah, like most things that are refreshing for adults, they do taste a little bit better when they're chilled, but it's an ambient product with a long shelf life and VAT zero for anyone that does...
There you go. That does so if anybody's interested in Naturelli...
Yep.
So that's nature with LLY on the end. Where can I get hold of these?
Yeah, so we're on Ocado, we're on Holland and Barrett online, we're in Boots stores nationwide, 250 of those. We do free delivery on our website for a small minimum order. And yeah, we're in Whole Foods Market in London, and then lots of independent farm shops, garden centres, delis, activity centres.
Everywhere, really.
Well, I wish. There's always more. There's always more places that we would love to be. Yeah.
Well, something a bit different. And if you like jelly, you need to check out Naturelli. Thank you very much, Liam.
Thank you. Have a lovely day.
Hi, we're back here in the studio, and we've got some lovely studio guests. We have Jack Fleming of Soup and Rick Hay, our superfoodist. Jack, I'm going to go over to you first. Soup is S-O-O-P and it stands for Stories on Our Plate. Tell us what that all means.
So we founded in March of last year. Just to give you a very, very concise story, my background is in conflict resolution, so neighbourhood mediation, dispute resolution.
So if I have an argument with my neighbour, you're the person that I need to call.
Well, I'll give you my number. And actually, the past couple of years, sort of drawing my love of food and a lot of peace-building work together, sort of academically and practically. And very, very roughly at the time, that was the kind of inspiration of Stories on My Plate. That name came first, and Soup just... real play on
got
words,
abbreviated,
really.
That was
fantastic.
And your organisation was founded in 2016, and it's particularly you're finding quite negative attitudes and marginalisation of refugee chefs in particular. So just explain a bit more in depth about what you're trying to do.
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is there's three co-founders to Soup, and we really came together with quite different backgrounds, but really sort of different angles of how we view food. So what I always say to people is that, you know, Soup really wasn't a reaction to what we see in Syria. It's not a kind of solving kind of enterprise with the crisis that we see. We really came together with our kind of attitudes towards food and how that can sort of celebrate diversity and bring together commonality.
And the way that you do that is through this 10-week culinary program.
Exactly.
To take the refugees and give them education and the skills to be able to cook.
Exactly. So it's very, very, very relaxed but very enriching program that basically is, 10-week program, and really sort of brings in people from the industry. So it's a very sort of network and kind of mentoring type program, because I think what we found was that people were just fantastic cooks. And I think we didn't go down the patronizing route of sort of, you know, teaching people how to finely chop a tomato. But there are, you know, levels of professional skills. I mean, my colleague's a professional chef. But I think what was really enriching about the program so far is actually sort of bringing in pop-up chefs, food entrepreneurs, really bring them in and actually delivering lessons themselves. And then one of the ways we also, so that's in the form of sort of ambassadorial program. And then we sort of actually do a kind of role swap. So our participants actually sort of teach their own recipes to the group. So it's a very, very humanizing way of kind of using food. And actually for us, it's sort of taking away the othering. You know, me and you, we're sort of, we have our differences and...
Do we? I don't know. I met you before, Joe. No, I know what you mean, but yeah.
You know, it's just a really, really down to earth. Mm. We don't get too sucked into sort of debates about integration and sort of... The program is geared up to our participants really trying to break into the industry, really getting opportunity.
And building people's confidence,
Exactly. And it's very designed for people who have sort of quite early sort of food ideas. So we have a fantastic lady from Nigeria who, and it's interesting, we had that discussion about African cuisine, and she, you know, she's got a really, really interesting sort of blend between kind of her influences here and then, you know, the food back home. And she wants to, you know, she wants to launch her own catering business here. So it's a really sort of, it's just a really great humanising
thing. So have the participants generally had an experience? So when you say they're early on their culinary journey, are most of them trained chefs originally, or have they worked in food, or are they more domestic food people?
So it's quite a mix, to be honest. I think most of them have had some level of experience working in cafes or doing a little bit of a couple of catering gigs themselves, but most of them actually are home cooks, and they're really looking to sort of take that step forward, really sort of break in, actually. And I think it's sort of a mixture. We really open it up to people if they want to, you know, be a restaurant chef, if they want to be a pop-up chef. This current program now is very focused on supper clubs. One thing we did at the start of in October of last year is we started our monthly supper club series, which I think for us was a way of kind of sort of really promoting what we stood for. So our kind of philosophy around common ground and food.
So what is a supper club? What's the sort of format of that?
So it's a food and storytelling supper club. So we have around about 30, 35 guests. And it's really sort of showcasing it, the particular guest chefs. So we've had chefs from Istanbul, Ukraine, Palestine. You know, we've had a real sort of nice mix. And actually really nice mix, really good platform for people to share their stories. You know, and that's why we're called Stories on Plate, because I think that's a way in for us to say, we all have a story to tell. You know, it's not, my story is not exclusive to yours. Mm. We all have a story to tell. And I think for us, that's what I really wanted to sort of hammer home quite early on, is that's the sort of way in, a humanising way in, to sort of take away the kind of labels.
I mean, the really interesting thing about food, and Guy and I find this all the time, is that every guest we have is always, well, what's your story? Because
it's the most interesting part, isn't it?
And their,
absolutely.
Their production of the whatever product they've got is about a story of some sort.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And it's a nice thing to talk about. And also when you look at sort of Ollie's, you know, research and all that, underneath that, the reason why we're a little bit frustrated by this is because we don't know what the stories are behind it.
Yeah.
It's very story-driven, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Mm. Yeah.
And tied up with travel. And I think with what you're doing is it does allow people to immerse themselves in the English language as well, if they're struggling with that a bit. I'm sure it helps.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think our kitchen sessions are very, very down to earth.
Yeah.
You know, we do sort of, you know, it really helps them with their sort of conversational English. But it's not too much focused on that. I think it's really just letting the food speak for itself. Mm. And we're all just good friends. You know, that really is the great sort of feel about what we're doing at the moment.
Sounds like
and
a great environment, yeah.
What's the point of the supper clubs? Is that to promote these chefs to a wider community?
Yeah, so I think the reason why we start in October is really to kind of get the supper club series going. So we do this every single month. And really the kind of the longer term aim is to have that readily available every single month, so that our participants, when they leave the teaching programme, they can actually sort of step in. Yeah. And really, it's really an idea of kind of practicing their supper clubs. And then at the end of the programme, we're doing a celebratory supper club, which is led by them. So it's a real sort of, it's a combination of things, kind of communicating what our philosophy.
This really is right up your street, Guy. You should pop along.
It does sound great.
Absolutely.
And it's like an inbuilt distribution strategy for these guys. You know, this may be their first kind of foray into the world of, you know, professional cooking. And you've created this space where they can come and they can get together and they can maybe show off the skills of their own culture and heritage. But also then you can have them present that to other people. I was going to ask, actually, is it the supper clubs, are they for other people in the refugee community, or is it just, you know, the wider community who come along to these?
It's for everyone. You know, we try to engage with the diaspora community. But I think that a lot of our work, what we'd really try, and we're always looking to evolve this, is how can we connect our way of thinking and our day-to-day program with the, you know, the public. Mm. And that's really important to us. And we'll be launching... with our next program in the autumn, we'll be inviting the general public into our sessions as a sort of workshop, sort of eat together. It's just things like that, which I think is just a sort of connector. Because I think, you know, we're not a sort of, you hear some words like incubator programs, which is very sort of, which very much has its place. But I think for us, it's really trying to find that way of kind of connecting everyone together, really.
Yeah. So it's called Stories on Our Plate. So that's SOOP. And you're mostly based in Northeast London. How are you funded?
So it's been a nice combination. So we teamed up with an organisation called Unlimited, and they do kind of early stage seed money, which is fantastic. So we got together with them around about October, which is really helpful for us to sort of really, well, firstly kickstart with the subclub series, but also do you know, plan for the programme work. And we've got a few other little pots of funding as well. We're actually all alumni from SOAS, the University of London SOAS. So we've had some really, really good links with them. And we make money from the dinners as well. And the money from that goes towards our programme work. So I think we've been, I don't know what you call yourself these days, you know, social enterprise,
to get
social business.
Trying,
you know,
to get self-sufficient as a social enterprise.
Yeah, yeah, very, very scalable, but done at a very, very patient, sort of progressive way. So I think it's great.
So can I talk a little bit about you? Because this is, I don't know how you, did you have a really argumentative brother or sister when you were little or something like that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so you did go to the University of Bradford and you studied conflict resolution and peace studies.
Yes.
You then did the same at the American University in Kosovo in 2012, and you got an international studies qualification at the University of London. You've had a number of jobs and you've worked at the International Alert as a project coordinator and has also been a conflict resolution trainer. Could do with you at work sometimes.
I'm always available.
So, yeah. A bit of a side income.
So just explain to me what that is. I mean, I've never heard of anybody that's done that.
Yeah, a few people say that to me. Yeah. I mean, I think, I studied originally at the Peace Studies Department in Bradford. So that's
which
where
is
I
world famous.
lived off curry for about, you know, seven days a week. And my focus there was on local conflict resolution. So it was. And that's where I worked with a company there.
So give some examples of local conflict resolution.
Oh, it can be anything. It can be loud dogs. It can be noisy neighbours. It can be a tree sort of going over someone's fence.
Oh, wow.
Very day-to-day stuff.
So who do you work for? The council or something?
We were an NGO ourselves and we sort of had links with the council and very, very day-to-day neighbourhood cases. I mean, I've seen it all, really.
Right, tell me your
which
funniest.
I don't know if it's a good or bad. I've had people.
Please tell me your funniest.
Well, the funniest one. Well, scary as well.
All right, go on then.
I had a chap who was doing a session together, and it was a neighbourhood session, and he just flipped. He just got really, really angry. And often with these people, they come together and they've really not had a conversation with each other. A lot of these disputes.
A lack of communication.
Yeah, they've had an altercation and then they've not been able to kind of follow that up. And it's quite staggering, really. And we all do it. I mean, we're all guilty of it. And he just flipped. He just absolutely flipped. And he got the table, and I was with my colleague, got the table and flipped it all up high in the air. And, you know, it was borderline violent. And, you know, we had to
what
calm
was that
it
down. Sounds more than borderline to me.
It's pretty more than
what
borderline.
What was that over?
Oh, you know, if
something ridiculous.
Some weeds in the garden or something.
Yeah. No, a lot of it is noise complaints. So yeah. it was young families, things like that.
Yeah.
So I did that for a long time, and then sort of moved into sort of more training work. So we did a lot of work with the NHS, sort of workplace mediation, things like that. But I've always been a big foodie at heart, and I was sort of since starting Soup, I really wish that I used some food in mediation because that's really the kind of underbelly of Soup is trying to sort of
use food
as a common, and you've probably heard about stories and food now. It's becoming a bit on trend, but it's really sort of digging quite deeper about how we can sort of utilize it for purposes of common ground.
It's a great way to bring people together, isn't it?
Terrific.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, we like it because, mind you, there's no food here, is there?
There's nothing to taste this week,
no,
so we've been a bit shortchanged there.
Yeah. Well, that's all very interesting, I think. And again, it underlines the power of food to bring people together.
And the power of community as well.
Absolutely.
So we've had a little discussion before, haven't we, Rick? Tell us all about you and what you do.
Yeah, I'm a qualified nutritionist and herbalist, and I started out many years ago in Australia actually teaching sport to kids, and then got a real interest in how health and fitness could help their academic prowess. So fast forward from that, I then managed some vitamin companies and always formulated my own programs. This was prior to the obesity crisis really hitting. And so what I've then done from then on is try to find easy ways for people to stay in shape through real food and through some food choices. Because I think what's happened to...
Are you listening to this guy?
Very much so.
I think what's happened to food...
Thank you, Sue.
to food, at least in my industry, is that it's become very complicated. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Everybody thinks there has to be a set way. And sometimes, and I'm sure you'd all know this, that the healthiest way to a healthy diet is just a lot of coloured food and a lot of different regional foods, a lot of variety, and you're there. I mean, I've just taught myself out a lot of jobs really by saying that one sentence. But often it's overcomplicated, so I try to find ways for people to not be scared of certain foods, and certainly not to be scared of certain food groups, because what we've got now is total demonisation.
People not eating carbohydrates, which is not great for kids, is it?
Well, no, and
sporting people.
You know, you cut out, and even if. And so something a little bit controversial here, a nutritionist saying that not all sugar is bad and sometimes sugar is okay. And if you're not overweight or obese, then it's a nice energy food in the morning and it tastes good. So there's a lot in my area. So I spend a lot of time writing articles, doing media,
I don't think it's just complex. I just think it's contradictory. So the advice you get is contradictory. And certainly I would imagine, I don't have young children anymore, but if you're a parent, it's quite difficult to find your way through that and, you know, make the right decisions.
It is. And then as well, you've got not only, you know, magazines and the media, which I'm part of, telling you something different every 3 years. You now have research telling you something different. And then you have sort of quick fixes that promise, you know, the use of food to get you results that you're really not going to get. You know, I do a lot with superfoods, which, as you'll know, I mean, they don't have to be exotic. They can be turmeric, they can be beetroot, they can be spinach.
Even chocolate.
That's nutrient-dense, dark chocolate. So it's about kind of getting that education out there, but it is very hard. Mm. I think what happens then is when it gets difficult, people switch off. And that's my hardest challenge, is to get them to realise that it's not too difficult, and also to realise that this whole term about superfoods, even though I use it a lot, is just a nutrient-dense food.
Mm.
It's something that's just good for you.
It's
an
just
apple,
good
an
stuff.
Apple is a superfood, but, you know, marketers of, I think...
Eggs are superfoods.
Yeah, well, eggs are often nature's true superfood. Fish oil, for example, is wonderful. So it is a long battle to sort of get people back into eating everything. And also I think the whole thing around food is, you've touched on it here today, food is enjoyable. It should be enjoyed. If you then, and a big section of our community are out there demonizing food, you have, you know, in particular a lot of women and guys now as well, but thinking they can't eat something and worrying about it all day instead of just enjoying
the
food.
It's very stressful, isn't it, when you behave like that?
Well, what will end up happening is your adrenal glands produce more adrenaline. You then get into a state where you actually don't metabolize fat very well, so you actually worry yourself bigger. You'd be better off having
that must
the muffin.
Be it for me. I'm just so stressed.
I'm worrying myself bigger because I'm absolutely starving at the moment. My stomach's rumbling, if you can hear it over the microphone. You're also sort of well known for looking at anti-aging food. What does that mean? Because I know you're actually 97, but you look about 40.
I was going to say, I thought you were going to say I'm looking 97. There's a lot of English honesty for me. As I get older, and even years ago, I started to look in to components of different foods and how they, if they're backed by science, can help us with our cellular health. Now, that doesn't mean I'm promising the fountain of youth, but what I can say, though,
I was hoping to learn that today,
is that you can get your body healthy so that 80, without being fanatical, you can still play tennis, you can still ride a bike. And I think what's happened is, you know, the whole anti-aging thing has been hijacked by the fact that we think we want to live forever. What I'm all about is, as we're living older, helping people to live better. And again, it just comes back to one anti-aging tip is colourful food, colourful fresh food. It's the number one. You don't even have to buy a special book for it, although I have one.
Which you can buy at Amazon.
but now I'll just talk myself out of those sales. Yeah. Fabulous. But you can do it just with a lot of coloured foods. And
But I go to the gym and you know, I'm embarrassed because I might be the oldest person there. No, I am not. Mm. It is full of people who are in their 70s who are just doing not hugely strenuous stuff, but good stuff. And there is no reason, unless you've got health problem, why you can't do that when you're older. I don't see why not. And I mean, I'm not super fit, but I'll often sit there and be on the rowing machine for half an hour or whatever, and some 24-year-old comes and falls off after 5 minutes, you know, but I've built up to it. And there's no reason why you can't as you're older, is there? And build it into your daily routine. Doesn't have to be the gym. Could be a nice walk or anything, really.
Yeah, I mean, your body's designed to have, obviously, a certain amount of good nutrition. But if you take food on the one hand with health, and then you look on the other hand, we've also got muscles, and those muscles need to move. Mm. And even if you move them gently with Tai Chi, even if you move them gently with some yoga or gentle Pilates, it doesn't have to be lifting weights. However, lifting weights is particularly useful for us. And as you know, if you lift weights more, you're going to encourage lean muscle development. It means you can have that piece of cake, because lean muscle burns fat more efficiently.
Is that how you live your life, Ollie? You can have that piece of cake because you've got lean muscles.
I think I certainly subscribe to the philosophy that, you know, you try and burn at both ends. Mm. You know, I probably bike my son to school every day, and I'm kind of, you know, constantly running around as an entrepreneur. So I suspect I could probably eat a bit more healthily and probably drink a few less glasses of wine. But, you know, I think if you've got to try and get balance, haven't you?
Yeah,
and I think that's what actually, I mean, I'm interested by, you know, because when we did this recent research about health and which community are concerned about what they're putting in their body, there was a very clear message that the higher income groups were more concerned and the lower income groups were less concerned. And it's absolutely clear, based upon the ones who were turning, you know, the lower income groups were turning towards more processed food, you know, avoiding cooking from scratch, less really. So there's this kind of double-edged sword, which is they're doing all the wrong, you know, the low-income groups are doing less cooking, they're buying more processed food, and they're less concerned. Whereas the
and obviously that's a generalisation, as we know, but a lot of people call that health fatalism, and there's a real distinct mindset, which is about, well, I had a granddad who smoked 60 fags a day, you know, and he lived to 85. Yeah, but he's one of 1 million that managed to do that, you know. Yeah. And there is this thing called health fatalism, where he's thinking, well, it doesn't matter because this is going to happen anyway, or that's going to happen. But the real message, Rick, is you can take control, can't you? And even if it's small things around the edges, it helps.
Yeah, even if you know, rather than deciding to, you know, demonise food or cut out one food group, just start off by having a couple of healthier meals every week. That's it. That's enough. That's all you have to do. And then what you'll find is your palate will probably change over time as well. You know, I mean, the liver loves some bitter foods. I know it's not popular, but it really does. And that'll help with the fat burning. So the occasional choice away from sugar, even though you can have it as a treat. But it is achievable. And I think the thing is, I'd love to see, as you probably all would, I'd love to see food and nutrition taught more in schools. I think we're missing a trick. You know,
well, the Queen's speech was great for that, wasn't it? Yeah. And that's really helpful because, again, food and kids and stuff is off the agenda.
And it's so sad, you know. I did a piece for a major news company a while ago, you know, rounding, I don't want to get controversial around the sugar tax and all that, but there's so much more we can do. And having worked with education and seen how easy it can be, I'm really cross because, you know, I spend a lot of time teaching math to kids and teaching them chemistry, but not a lot of time teaching them about food. And that's really what they need to know, because without all that, the rest doesn't matter, you know.
But it's so short-termist, the current policies, because in the end, if we don't attack this stuff, it's just going to come and bite us in 50, 40, 30 years time when the bills
but
those
politicians aren't around, so they're not bothered about that by then. It's not
that's
long
the trouble
term,
with
no,
it.
I know, it's so short-term.
It's always short-term. Yeah. And Jack, you're really, you know, in terms of you know what you're doing, you can absolutely see how food is so important to communities and you know people who probably aren't very educated in food.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's been really good for us as a team is we've learned so much from the people we work with. You know, because you've got that kind of very homely, you know, we have a small kitchen where we do our trainings, and you know it's really sort of feeds into that sort of home cooked food, and we've learned so much from that, and you know, as you said, you know, really really colourful food, you know, ridiculously interesting food that some of which we've never come across before. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's, you know, something we really try and promote at Soup is kind of local produce, really understanding where your food is coming from, really kind of respecting that, because I think, you know, we're very focused on the sort of social delivery side of things, but you know, equally important to that is,
so you've got to eat food or you're going to die. And
well put.
It employs more people in the UK than any other sector. We've got an obesity problem and it's still not on the political agenda. It's unbelievable.
Some of the stats on obesity are crazy.
It's,
I pulled some up just
really
before we started.
No, seriously, it is. I mean, we're not normally political on this program, but you know, I'm just exasperated by it, frankly.
The problem is that I don't see there's enough anger about it.
I'm angry.
No, I know you are, but I don't think the press is generally angry about it. I don't think big corporates are really trying to do. I haven't looked enough in the detail, but one sense is they're paying lip service to it rather than actually really engaging in the agenda, and so it's not going to change.
Well, we normally end on a really good note, don't we, on this programme?
Let's find a good note.
Yeah, but it does make me angry. And, I you know, having worked in a lot of communities, you know, doing the sorts of things that Jack's doing, you know, a long time ago, you just see the power of it and how important it is for families to share and, you know, to try and get children to understand where things come from and what they're eating.
But I think...
And because then you will make the right choices.
So you want to end on a positive note. The positive note for me is that if you look at the UK... The UK has never been more passionate about food, never been more interested in talking about food, never more discussing it. And in the end, you can't get passionate about a processed bunch of food that tastes disgusting. So fundamentally, you've got the sort of the groundswell of interest. Now you've just got to kind of help ignite that interest in the right direction.
tell me something happy, happy now, Rick.
Something happy. Food can be easy.
Yeah, there you go. Jack?
Come to a soup supper club. 20th, 27th of July or next week.
Okay. Well, thank you both for joining me. I'm sorry to be a little bit pressed today. Don't forget to tweet
us. You need some lunch.
Yeah, if you have any comments or you want to suggest something that our politicians should do, please tweet me on @FoodTalkShow. You've been listening to The Food Talk Show with me, Sue Nelson, and my co-presenters, Guy Routledge of Food Rush and Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs. You can catch our show on a huge number of local radio stations now, stretching from California to Kent, Malta to Michigan, or you can download one of our hundreds of podcasts at www.foodtalk.co.uk. And I look forward to speaking to you all next week. So thank you very much for joining us on. Cheers.